Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we have a very special California edition of this week's podcast.
It's very exciting.
It's just the two of us, but we're sitting in a lovely wine garden, which is affiliated with the lovely Corey Shockey's favorite bar here in Sonoma County.
That's right. So we're at the Roan Room for the Girl and the Fig, recording in their lovely wine garden, sipping a very lovely rosé, which is a Grenache blend rosé, because apparently it's Grenache week here in Sonoma County.
Which is fabulous. Who knew there was a Grenache week?
That's right.
Why isn't every week Grenache week?
Who says it isn't? Who says it isn't?
Well, we're going to need, hopefully this one very nice glass will suffice for the next many minutes of conversation here. We have a few different topics to get through, and we're actually going to go back to a segment we haven't done in a while. This is still a thing.
This is still a thing is still a thing. It's very meta.
Mind blown. Radha wanted to do Afghanistan for This Is Still a Thing. I reminded her we'd done a lot of Afghanistan coverage already. So instead, we're actually going to talk a little bit about climate change, which I'm not sure. I guess we talked about with Paris probably a year or so ago.
That's
but
right.
I don't think we've talked about it too much recently. But there was kind of a flurry of news this week. The week before last, there was a Global Climate Action Summit actually here in the Bay Area, which was kind of an effort to get leaders and philanthropists and business people from around the world rededicated to climate action. And there was actually a fair amount of optimism that came out of that, was my understanding, including statements from a lot of the world's mayors and some of the kind of sub-state leadership to, you know, even when there's lack of action at the national level, to pursue climate change goals, including being carbon neutral by 2050, I think is one of the was one of the statements that came out of that summit. But there's other less great news on the climate horizon as well.
So it looks like we're not going to meet the Paris targets, which isn't a really big shock to everyone. But for those who may remember, we used to be in this Paris climate agreement before President Trump pulled the U.S. out. But there's still, you know, like about 200 countries signing an agreement that's trying to set a limit for emissions with an aim to reducing to stop the rise in temperature by 2 degrees. The idea was to sort of have the countries have joint action on efficiency, emissions reductions, a whole host of programs. And based on the most recent assessment, emission reduction rates have not been sufficiently high across the board, but including in the US, to really support this. And there are sort of ongoing talks by the UN lead on this, on what further global actions were needed and how much of this needed to be borne by developing countries versus developed countries, with a lot of pushback, not surprisingly, from places like China and India.
Which has been part of the debate, certainly since the Kyoto Accords, probably from since the Rio agreements, you know, in the 90s, even before that, which is the relative, you know, who should have to carry the heavier lift in terms of some of those reductions. There was also a story, I don't know if you saw this, Radha, in the Washington Post this week about a new research study that showed that even with temperatures only slightly higher than they are right now, at some period 125,000 years ago, there was a pretty substantial melt-off in the Antarctic that led to sea level rises that were 20 to 30 feet higher than current levels, which basically means that if we're in some sort of temperature feedback loop where we're getting kind of accelerating returns on the temperature increases, that we could have much higher sea levels much sooner than maybe even some of the forecasters in the Paris Accords are discussing. So, you know, there's not a lot of like super great news in this area. And, you know, at one point, the Pentagon was actually quite forward leaning on climate issues, considering it was in the QDR as a national security issue. There's actually a fair amount of planning that goes along with sea level rise, because it turns out we have like Navy bases.
Right. Also turns out the sea level affects a lot of things we care about, like cities that are next to seas.
It's irrelevant. I mean, some hugely significant portion of the world population lives within,
correct,
you know, 50 miles of a coastline.
Right.
But it also does always sort of strike me, you know, there are these big debates that we have on U.S. foreign policy and even some longer term global security, you know, kinds of issues. And you can get way into the weeds on that. And then it's like, yeah, but We might just all be underwater in 100 years.
That's right.
Right. In William Gibson's book, The Peripheral, he refers to it as jackpot, which is this set of climate catastrophes that trigger financial and political destabilization.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, it's really, it's a real, you know, sunny, you know, future vision of the world. But every once in a while, when I see, you know, stories about both sea level rise or kind of, I think the Capital Weather Gang had something about how this was the warmest set of summer nights that they have on record, which reminds me of night warming, which was a classic like high school debate argument on all the climate topics, you know, night warming good. But that like, oh, we're just marching ourselves towards jackpot.
That's right. No, it's the end of time, but that's why this is still a thing.
And that's why we're drinking rosé at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Correct. Guys, I always have to drink in the morning when we record these podcasts. So it's just,
I guess that's true. I mostly just drink coffee these days when we record the podcast, which, you know, we'll see if we have a better outcome since we have delicious wine to go with us. So that's kind of climate change. It's still a thing.
Yeah.
It's still a thing diplomatically that the rest of the world is heavily engaged in. But like on many topics these days, we're kind of just
kicking the can down the road.
Kicking the can down the road / abdicating U.S. global leadership? That's question right. mark?
Yeah. Exclamation.
To what end? Like, did we get anything for leaving the Paris Peace Accords?
Well, we stopped making any... pretending like we were going to make an effort to reduce
emissions. Peace Accords. I meant Paris Climate Accords. It's not Vietnam.
Yeah. I know what you mean. I think, you know, we didn't pursue a number of the efficiency regulations that were a big push in the Obama administration. And certainly the incentives to switch over from things like coal and even oil and gas to alternative energy sources that are not carbon emitting. Has gone way down. So, I mean, we got potentially some votes in coal country.
Super. I'm glad that that's working out for us. Speaking of some folks that are kicking the can down the road / are bailing out of things and not getting anything, you know, them, there was no like real major news on the Brexit front this week as we switch gears into keeping up foreign relations. Other than just like a series of continued stalled talks between Theresa May's government in the UK and the EU leadership in Brussels, where the Brits continue to basically be like, so how about now? How about now? How about we still get access to all of your market and we don't make any of the other concessions or changes? And the Europeans just keep saying no. And as we've noted a few times on the podcast, the real sticking point, and everything else is sort of negotiable or could at least be somewhat fungible, but is this border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. And nobody seems to have a creative solution for how you get around that.
Well, that's right. And reports were this week, you know, as part of the regulatory framework that Theresa May was considering allowing the DUP, the Northern Irish Party that her government had to form a coalition with to maintain power, were considering giving them some kind of veto power in this negotiation, which, as you might imagine, went over great in a place where the entire negotiated solution rested on power sharing and then more or less moving away from being British to being European, making the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland softer. And thus sort of loosening up a lot of the tensions that related to which part was the Republic and which part was still part of the United Kingdom.
So basically the UK is still working on a crash out plan. They're going to have no negotiated settlement prior to, and just like one day there's going to be a substantial amount of tariff and probably, I guess, non-tariff barriers between the British market and the much, much larger European market. And it's going to be so painful for everyone in like March of next year when that actually comes slamming down.
That's right. And I think part of it also means that a lot of the agreements on what parts of the regulations and laws that have been passed at the EU level that the UK accepted as part of sort of EU coverage, which of those will govern UK businesses is also kind of up in the air. So in addition to like the direct costs and disruption, there's this sort of regulatory uncertainty, which, as you might imagine, businesses love.
Yes, everybody loves regulatory and not to mention the whole like financial market.
That's right.
Kind of the way that money moves between London and the rest of Europe. So we'll stay tuned. Meanwhile, on the other side of the world, there was another intra-Korean summit. And Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in got together, did a little mountain hiking and continued their improved and increasingly close relationship between those two parties, while the U.S. and China and probably some others kind of sit on the sidelines, which is a very interesting set of regional developments. And I guess we kind of continue down this road of, I don't know, deliberately talking past each other. There were statements that came out with regard to, quote, denuclearization by the North Koreans, but we're still sort of in this like willful denial or willful misreading of what exactly they mean by that, because it seems pretty clear that denuclearization does not mean disarmament.
Right.
And that's, you can want it to mean something else, but it doesn't seem as though Kim...
I want a pony.
Right. Several ponies, in fact. But it doesn't seem like Kim is really talking about disarmament here.
Right.
Meanwhile, you know, the claims for denuclearization of the peninsula are also as part of the North's call and the South's now call for a formal end to the Korean War.
Yeah, so I was going to say, in some ways, I'm of two minds about where we've ended up in Korea. On the one hand, I feel like it would be great if the U.S. and China could jointly help sort of shepherd this to a more comfortable solution for everyone, the region and the world. And given the current state of U.S. and Chinese relations, that seems particularly unlikely. On the other hand, it seems like sort of in the absence of any grown-ups actually being helpful, that there is this sort of regional effort to move this, at least nudge this in a direction which doesn't resolve a lot of the geopolitical issues like denuclearization, but does kind of ratchet down the border tension and a lot of the sort of like...
For sure.
Threat and saber rattling that was happening. And like, that feels like it's kind of good. So like, maybe kind of letting them have some ownership and accountability is actually a silver lining.
No, I think it's definitely an improvement over where things were, you know, a year or 18 months ago. The question is sort of what happens to that saber rattling when the Trump administration like really wakes up one day and realizes that it was not even sold a bill of goods. It wasn't actually sold anything,
right,
but that they went and bought a bill of goods.
Well, I mean, they solved the Korean crisis. So no, in more
and
serious,
Kim is being very strategic in the sorts of things
totally
that he's offering, right? Like, they're more than breadcrumbs.
Right.
They're not really, like, he's not really shutting down Yongbyon. He's not allowing IAEA inspectors back in everywhere. But he's like dribbling and drabbing, you know, certain sorts of missile test facility shutdowns and some other pieces that look like confidence building measures.
Right.
And maybe they do form the basis for some longer term tit for tat.
Exactly. So that's what I was going to say. Like, look, the Iran deal didn't like sort of come out of nowhere. And I actually think the best thing that could happen is the Trump administration feels like they've solved this, don't pay very much attention to it, and we get some sort of meaningful but minimal progress that just ratchets down the tension so that at some point when we sort of return to a more deliberate and measured process in Europe and in the U.S. and possibly with the U.S. and China, that there is sort of a foundation to build upon to sort of re-engage on this. And that's like, there's no guarantee that Trump won't decide that, you know, Kim Jong-un embarrassed him and he needs to tweet out. But if we can kind of keep the Korea's not on his radar map, like maybe this is actually a helpful way to advance the ball without...
And one issue that I have, or one of a couple maybe, but is the maximum pressure campaign is essentially over.
Yeah.
There was a headline in the Washington Post about minimum pressure, and then a separate article talking about kind of increased oil smuggling and mm-hmm. how that's really allowed the North to basically now have its cake and eat it too, yeah, on with weapons and potentially some economic growth. The flip side is also, I mean, this essentially, that strategy is basically accepts North Korea as a nuclear weapons state.
Yes.
And so... how do we all feel about that? And how do we feel about that as a matter of American policy? I mean, it took a decade or more to like come to terms with India's nuclear weapon status.
Right.
And they're like a reasonably responsible global player.
So I don't think if I were to draw up my plan for the world, it would involve the North Korean regime having functioning intercontinental missiles with nuclear warheads, right? Like, that's not like a desired
dream state. You're not on board for that super.
But like, given the world we live in, I don't think we're going to get to a place where, absent some of these sort of relationship building measures, we can even get them to be more responsible in how they deal with the weapons they do have. So I think, like, is it something we're comfortable with? Like, no. Is it something we might have to sit with the discomfort and kind of try to move, at least accept where we are right now and for the next few years kind of accept that we're going to get minimal progress and try to have some foundational relationship issues, like maybe, right? Like maybe that's kind of the best we can hope for. And we're just going to tolerate this uncomfortable missiles program until we can get back there. And again, Iran is a pretty good model for this in the sense that they went really far down.
Wouldn't it be ironic if we essentially ended up in like the Iran model, but for North Korea, but also not for actual disarmament? I mean, like now my head just like super hurts and I can't tell if more or less wine is the solution for that.
We have some rosé here.
Shifting gears just a little bit, one of the stories we're tracking this morning was what looks like a terrorist attack inside Iran. There was an attack on a military parade in a southern city, so not in Tehran. And we don't have a lot of details other than they're kind of blaming sort of the usual suspects. Hopefully we'll have some more information on this over the next couple of days.
But it was an attack on a military parade, so I think that kind of with actually pretty like fatal consequences. I think the most recent death toll was at like 25. So it was like a pretty serious attack. And I guess the question will be both sort of who's responsible and then most critically, like what does Iran actually do?
Yeah.
Especially given everything that's going on in Syria.
And what is going on in Syria, Radha?
Well, so we had a pretty exciting week that reminded everyone that there are a lot of militaries fighting in Syria right now. So the Syrians, and that's like Assad's military, flag military, sort of accidentally shot down a Russian aircraft.
Sorry, not sorry. Like
and
what?
they claimed that that accident occurred because they were under pressure from aggressive Israeli military tactics. So basically blaming Israel for shooting down the Russian jet. Now then, the Israeli prime minister was basically like, hey, 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 this is all you. And we have proof. We'll talk to Russia and show them our
because
proof.
Because Netanyahu and Putin actually have a quite close personal relationship,
which
even though they're
weird
on very different sides of this whole specific Syria thing. Yes.
And Putin then actually issued a statement really ratcheting down the tensions and calling this a sort of tragic series of events or a tragic accident.
Which is kind of the second, or at least the second, maybe the third or fifth time that Putin's done a pretty dramatic climb down on a specific incident.
Yeah.
Remember there was that incident with the Russian like contractors,
right?
The sort of Russian mercenaries where the Americans just slaughtered, just laid waste to a substantial number of Russian nationals. And the Russians were like, we're good.
Yeah.
No big deal.
I mean, the thing here is that we have to remember Russia has a really vested interest in maintaining the Assad regime and they're basing options there in Syria. And so you kind of forget that the Russians, the Israelis, frankly, the U.S., some European, some Gulf states all have like flagged. I'm not talking about proxy forces, like actual military actions happening in or around Syria all simultaneously with no real like combined mission plan, no defined information sharing.
Well, there was some like deconfliction centers for a while, but I'm not 100% sure what the status of those is at this point.
That's right, and they don't appear to work that well.
Well, and they don't include the Israelis.
Correct.
Right, that was a U.S.-Russia situation.
Right, and so, you know, we're in a situation where there's a lot of military action in a pretty confined area with, frankly, catastrophic humanitarian consequences, but also like pretty non-trivial geopolitical risks here.
And still an incredible amount of fog of war, right? These are very sophisticated militaries. It turns out air defense, complicated. Turns out figuring out exactly what happened and who or why is, you know,
tricky.
a relatively complicated problem. And then you kind of, I think about adding that into sort of the propaganda pieces that are already playing, you know, and the ability to, you know, fake or adjust or manipulate these videos and these facts like in real time. Like that gets tough, really. Really fast. So
yes,
we continue to keep an eye on Syria, but it's definitely a different set of like conflict dynamics than it was even a year ago.
That's right. And, you know, I think just sort of pivoting on this Russia point a little bit more broadly, like, as you say, Putin has really sort of emerged in this space as someone who seems to be playing a lot of sides in a lot of different conditions. And sort of more recently on the other side of the world, Russia sold China a fighter jet and a missile system, prompting some like pretty serious U.S. sanctioning the...
Would you like to talk about trade?
I would.
Aghast?
I still don't really get it.
Tell us more about the Russians selling the Chinese things in our sanctions.
I mean, there's a chicken right here.
Well, that's something we've never said on the podcast before.
Right. I like birds. So, you know, Russia has sold China this fighter jet and these missile systems, and actually generally been sort of relatively robustly engaging sort of across the board on these issues. But in a world where China is already facing massive tariffs from the U.S. and really deteriorating,
which we'll get to.
Yeah, deteriorating relationship with the U.S., sanctioning, you know, China's military agency that does military purchases and then putting the head of that on the like frozen asset list is like a pretty aggressive U.S. response.
What was the violation? Like,
so they bought military goods, which violates the sanctions we have on Russia from post the Ukraine invasion.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And so
it's really like targeted Russian sanctions that
correct.
They're getting caught up in.
Correct.
Interesting. Huh. Okay.
But as you might imagine, given that we already have deteriorating relationships on the trade front, having pretty serious and like rapid fire, frankly, sanctions, including freezing assets, was a pretty aggressive move that, especially as we've sort of shut down these trade talks, China isn't sending trade negotiators over as planned. So the sort of both the economic negotiation channel and now this foreign policy negotiation channel are really sort of merging together on this set of economic issues happening with China.
So we slapped a whole bunch more tariffs on China this
right.
week, trade taxes, as we
That's
like
right.
to call them here. We're going to send Kai Rizdal a note and request that he also start calling them trade taxes.
Please, Kai, please.
On a regular basis. Reading up on that, I was interested to learn that the Chinese have run out of goods to put American goods to put tariffs on. And so now their response mechanisms either have to be other kinds of barriers to U.S. goods, maybe they now have to look outside of trade
correct.
In order to impose political costs or other kinds of financial costs
currency
on
manipulation, right?
Right, currency manipulation. But we're now, I mean, for a few months, we're sort of debating, are we in a trade war? This definitely feels like a trade war.
No, I mean,
like we're well into the tit for tat phase. And
right.
now we're even like past that where we can do one for one escalation. Now it's sort of. And the Trump administration basically was like, well, here we're going to do this, a 10% tariff till the end of the year. And if
right.
nothing else happens, and then it goes to 25
That's
or
right.
it's a lot.
So it's a pretty aggressive tariff, but also, you know, it's now we're basically taxing all of the goods that come in from China. And
to include now the actual consumer goods. So not
correct.
Just like the inputs to other American
correct.
Products, but actual things that Americans buy.
So that has two big consequences. One is prices for consumers could go up pretty quickly and shockingly pretty close to the midterm elections, which will be a sort of interesting dynamic to play
mm-hmm,
out.
Mm-hmm.
But the second thing is one of the things on the list that China could do is withhold intermediate goods. So remember, they have an integrated economic and political system. They can say we're just not going to, no Chinese company is allowed to sell America any blank. And then
right.
if we need that widget to build all the things, which like we do for all sorts of different kinds of inputs, we're kind of in trouble, right? Like we either mm-hmm. need to build out a way to internally source that, which we don't immediately have, or we need to cut production, which has, as you might imagine, both growth consequences and critically job consequences.
Interesting.
So
wow, it's like you're an economist or something, Radha.
I know. It's a good opportunity for me to really test all that economic theory that I never use and then see it play out in real life.
How do you feel about that?
You know, I have mixed feelings. I will say that I think I like to remind everyone and myself all the time that, you know, we call these taxes because they increase the price of goods. But like when we are sending money to China for all these things, like we're getting
stuff.
Right?
Right, we're
like
buying it.
On a lot of stuff.
It's like how I send money to Nordstrom.
Right.
But I get clothes.
Right.
Right. Or Sephora, and I get like skincare.
That's right.
Right. I'm not just
and
like.
And so we're, right. Like we're not like just giving it to the Chinese government. And when we put these tariffs on goods, the money that goes from those tariffs that where the U.S. government is getting revenues is coming essentially from American consumers, which is why
right.
we think of them as taxes. So I think like the whole situation where we've imposed massive taxes on like all of the goods that come from China is going to be really interesting one to see how it plays out with Trump's base, the people for whom they were hit very hard by the trade war. And I'll just close out the trade section with this. The Daily actually had a really excellent edition on Friday. This is the New York Times podcast talking
mm-hmm.
about how the financial crisis sort of created the underpinnings of inequality that impacted today's...
It's the 10th anniversary of the Lehman bailout, and they were kind of revisiting that.
And I think...
Or sorry, not the Lehman collapse,
right,
following no bailout.
And one of the points you were making was it just sort of exacerbated this inequality. And what's interesting about these taxes on Chinese trade goods is a lot of the consumer goods produced by China are relatively low-end cheap goods purchased by sort of lower middle class and poorer people, which...
But also everyone who shops at Old Navy.
Correct. And for whom even relatively small marginal price increases are really meaningful as a percent of income, right? And so the same sort of underlying inequality arguments that were talked about in that are sort of playing out here in a different front related to trade rather than financial barriers. So we shall see how that affects all sorts of things in the White House and political discussion.
And it's not clear that there's some sort of targeted financial relief the way that you might have for farmers, which has been discussed and is in progress, which is horribly economically inefficient, but is politically expedient when it's all consumers.
Correct.
It's not really clear. Like, do you just like issue like here everybody gets $100 to like compensate for your really expensive Chinese textiles and tennis shoes and toys?
That's right. And it's not clear that we can or should ramp up American-made manufacturing in those areas in a time horizon that would sort of meet the existing demand. Mm-hmm. And the fixed costs of doing that mean that even if in the long run those goods might be cost competitive with China, in the short run, they're just not going to be.
Right.
So that should be fun for us all.
White House mayhem?
Let's do it.
It's interesting. We had trouble coming up with some stories for this section, and I think that's just because like you and I are both pretty slammed this week. And so we kind of like... checked out of Twitter and the news and then had to like re-engage with it.
I know. It's the worst part of prepping for
and
this.
Still, basically, it's still just dumpster fire. Like we left and it was a mess and we came back and it was a mess. And it was an interesting experiment that like you could just not pay attention.
For
and
like
you
don't a really, whole week.
Maybe you miss something, but you don't miss a lot because it's just like still going to be there. Like KT McFarland's in the news this weekend.
I know.
Like, man, I didn't think that was a name we were going to hear back, you know, again, anytime soon.
And it definitely felt like we could have just ignored KT McFarlane for like 3 months and not missed a single
and did.
Bit of news.
Yeah, yes, we did. Exactly.
When
so
we say could, we mean did.
There's some documents. I guess this is a great example. So 5 days ago, the president was mau-mauing about declassifying a whole bunch of documents related to Corey Lewandowski's
No, Carter Page.
Carter Page. I have so hard time keeping everybody
so the,
apart.
This is the
Carter Page's FISA application.
Exactly. So remember, Carter Page, they wiretapped him,
right?
To prove that he was doing all sorts of inappropriate things with Russia.
Right.
He was,
And because there was reasonable suspicion that he was doing all kinds of terrible things with Russia.
Right. And approved for quite some time, and by both Trump and Obama era FISA courts and judges. Right. So this is kind of this point that like.
We're going to refer you to Lawfare
for more details on
and FISA court and everything
and
else.
And the FISA process and all of the F words that go with this. But the sort of critical piece that's actually of interest here is that there was a bunch of stuff in this that caught up Comey and McCabe, as well as a bunch of DOJ folks. And Trump said he wanted to declassify all this content. And everyone was kind of like, so about that.
How about no?
Sources and methods doesn't seem like, maybe we'll just, let's just not count this as an order. Foreign leaders called to ask the president not to declassify this material because it might be revealing.
Presumably because you're relying on some foreign sources.
Correct.
And cooperation with foreign intelligence services, which does happen more regularly than I think most Americans would probably anticipate.
Right.
And these folks are basically like, could
please,
you not?
Yeah.
Please don't.
The secret. It's literally secret, sir. Literally secret.
And to our great surprise, the president actually walked that back.
He sure did. Though everyone wants like speed. That was my takeaway. That was my takeaway from the tweet.
Yes, he had some tweets that talked about, well, it's unclear exactly what they were talking about. He basically reserves the right to declassify whatever he wants later.
That's right.
But for right now, he's not declassifying these documents.
Right. And I think, you know,
mayhem. That's the reason we call this segment White House Mayhem.
What's crazy about the whole thing is it makes it pretty clear that, one, there probably is, like, the fact that he had to reverse this suggests that this underlying argument that this was all based on this politically motivated Steele dossier is, like, probably not, like, totally on the level.
You think?
Point A. But point B, it really suggests that the president is so interested in sort of shaping the public narrative that he sort of hasn't historically really even understood the risks posed in declassification.
Oh, completely.
And I think, like, you know, we had this early, a while ago, discussion on can the president just declassify things whenever he feels like, and there is actually a process in classification review and blah, 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 but he also can declassify things whenever he wants. And it does speak to this broader question of, should we be having a conversation about a better classification process that isn't so dependent on a single point of failure and deals with a bunch of issues like classifying and declassifying, overclassification, classification releases. And so
I spent the week like passing my clearances to Lawrence Livermore Labs so I could go out there for some excellent conversations this week. And let me tell you, I would like to reform every part of the classification and clearance process.
No, but I mean, so like, and
by reform, I could also mean burn it to the ground, but not exactly in the way the president wants to burn it into the ground. Well, so that's, therein lies the rub.
And I think the problem is, you know, there is this overclassification problem, but there is also really sensitive material that gets classified, and figuring out where those sets intersect and creating the right incentive to classify things correctly
is tough.
And I think maybe, you know, with the intelligence agencies actually freaking out about this, we could like leverage that to have a process.
A lot of things, you know. Really, would you like a process, Radha? Would you send it to Valentine?
Yeah. So would.
But it's like a lot of things that this administration, you know, is sort of shaking up or blowing up. And it's like, you know, I could be on board for some changes to how we think about a substantial number of these issues. But man, this wasn't the way that I was going to go about it.
Nope.
And so I guess, like, are we going to get creative destruction, or are we just going to get like
destruction?
Are we just going to get like massively pissed off allies and like wantonly declassified material that politicizes entire branches of government for the rest of our lives? Who could say?
I think all of those.
All of the above. Great.
So crossing the river over to the Pentagon, I believe that Secretary Mattis may or may not be going to be fired again or not for the last 6 months, or he's Trump's BFF, ?
I mean, this is a sort of an interesting DC question. So there's a lot of stories that like you live in real time when you live in Washington, and then all of a sudden the New York Times finds out about it and they treat it like a capital A, capital S, a story. And you're like, Dad, it's not a story. Like, it's just, you know, kind of real life, but also just like day-to-day pieces. So the Times had a story this week about how Mattis and Trump are on the outs, and reading the story through, I was like, where's the news?
Right.
Like, there was nothing new here. There was one line about how maybe the president is getting briefings direct from the SOCOM commander and not filtering that to the Pentagon, which, okay, maybe.
Also wouldn't be the first time.
Right. But there was no, it drove me crazy because there was no actual new information in that story. But if you hadn't been living it in real time and sort of ruminating with your friends from the various agencies, maybe that was all like new to you and like newly in one place. And I mean, basically, I think the kind of inside baseball line is that Mattis moves on after the midterms, ? But I have like no actual content to that or no actual signal. Right. It's all noise to me. Clearly, the president's sort of irritated, but he's been irritated with other people at other times.
All the time. Like, for example, Jeff Sessions.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. I also think it wouldn't be wholly unusual for a Secretary of Defense transition after 2 years. These are like super intense jobs. And it also seems like more or less Mattis has not been a terribly outspoken in any direction, critical or supportive of the president. And so I think, you know, there's going to be scuttlebutt because it's Washington and that's kind of what we do. But absent a sort of substantive disagreement area, it's hard to imagine there being a lot on this, like absent something like the Gary Cohn, like.
Well, there were the comments attributed to him in the Woodward book.
Right.
Which,
but there were comments attributed to everyone.
Everyone. Which I all seem plausible to me.
That's right.
I'm just saying. That's like, right. It seems really plausible that man was called an idiot on several occasions by members of his staff, including the Marines.
That's right. I mean, that seems like it definitely happened.
You know, my short answer, to me, this always sort of feels like trying to like predict the NCAA basketball seeds, which will mean a lot to you, Radha, I can tell.
I do like filling out those charts and using arbitrary rules, like which mascot looks the toughest or which color is my favorite.
But it's like people who try to predict the seeds, they're just going to tell you. It's like trying to guess when Mattis is going to be fired. Look, guys, you're just going to wake up one morning and he's going to be fired. Like I don't see the value in the parlor room game or the reading of the tea leaves. It's a total arbitrary random number generating process.
That's right.
We'll know when we know.
Right. And I think in the meantime, of course, we still have the business to go about of running the military and transitioning a little bit here, running the State Department in the case of Secretary Pompeo.
Yeah, how's that going?
So I think it's complicated. It's tricky. The world is tricky. But so
they have swagger, though.
They do. They're back. The swag is back.
Oh my God, I couldn't believe that.
So there was a story about 2 weeks ago, maybe a week and a half ago in the New York Times about U.S. officials meeting sort of unofficially with some military or security apparatus leadership in Venezuela to talk about a potential regime transition. These folks had reached out. The folks, they did.
Right. As if the idea of American engagement with rogue military elements in a Latin American country has like no basis in history or is just sort of like a, you know.
Never happened.
Totally fine. Like just an innocuous meeting between maybe some administration officials and maybe some active duty Venezuelan military officers.
Don't ask too many questions.
Right.
So, but the thing I will say in defense of the State Department and in defense of the mission in Venezuela is like, look, military leaders thinking about doing something in their country want to talk to you and give you a heads up. You probably want to take the meeting. Talk quietly. I'm not saying you want to give them any aid. I'm not saying it should drive our foreign policy. But I'm just saying, not crazy to take the meeting.
It's a little crazy to take the meeting. You got to like...
Definitely crazy to tell the New York Times about it.
Right. So who told the New York Times is a great question.
Yeah.
Question you should ask every single day whenever you read a New York Times story. Because
right.
It's
exactly.
Just like who talked to Woodward. If it wasn't you, it's going to be a problem.
But sort of this follow... just yesterday, I think, Pompeo said in this discussion on Fox News that the U.S. is preparing a series of actions in Venezuela. And so there is like clearly... Like in terms of the actual conditions on the ground, terrible things happening in Venezuela. And we should probably get a guest and actually talk in more detail about the instability in Venezuela and kind of what's going on. But and the instability in Venezuela is actually driving some of the issues in the U.S., including like the unaccompanied minors crisis, a lot of displacement in South and Central America. So like it's not totally crazy that the U.S. has interest there. And Secretary Pompeo foreshadowed quote, series of actions that will be coming soon-ish?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm going to wait with bated breath on those. This is a great example where the lack of process and the ability for people with strong preferences for bad ideas to access senior administration officials makes me very nervous. Besides evacuating American citizens or doing some sort of neo from the embassy, like I have a hard time seeing like what the really, really strong American interests are here. But there are a number of folks who are highly motivated to increase U.S. participation. And
look, in fairness, the Maduro government is like not great. Right.
Oh, beyond not great.
And we have like sanctioned them. We've done some issues related to, oh, the chicken is back.
The chicken is back and is sitting next to me.
Could we not? Wow. That's a lot of chicken related interruptions in this pod.
You were talking about something.
Yeah. So the Trump administration has, like, you know, sanctioned the government. We've issued some restrictions related to trading, like, Venezuelan debt bonds and so forth. So, like, we've done some stuff
right
there. Having the Secretary of State talk about issuing action certainly suggests the level of the stuff we've done could increase. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's just something worth keeping an eye on, but also, and very much to your point, something for which having a national security process... An understanding, transparency about that process and that it exists sort of would build a lot of confidence when we hear the action.
I guess I'm glad that it's coming from state and not from DOD.
Yeah.
But
ish.
We'll see. Okay. Pop culture.
Yeah.
You have a pop culture.
I do. I have a pop culture. So I was, playing on the internet while trying to prep for this episode and heard that the, you know, Marvel has a new Captain someone. Some chick superhero.
Captain Marvel, in fact.
Captain Marvel, right. I kept calling her Captain America, and Aaron's like, it's just a totally different thing, Radha. But she, so there's this movie, female lead, looks like her costumes are pretty good.
Yeah, Brie Larson.
Yep.
She's going to be great.
Apparently a number of the really awesome humans that are on the internet kept telling her that she was kind of wooden and needed to be smiling more, and she released just like an amazing Instagram stories pasting smiles on the face of all of the various Marvel like screenshots from the different movies in the like Marvel Empire, and it was a delight.
I do think that Captain America should smile more.
I mean, Captain America can
kind of do whatever he wants.
Whatever he wants, Aaron.
I watched Solo on the flight out here, which I hadn't seen yet, which is sort of indicative of its box office success or lack thereof.
So it was great, huh?
It's fine. And maybe it's just that, like, my expectations, like, were ratcheted way down. It's a perfectly enjoyable Star Wars adjacent movie.
But it didn't actually have Indiana Jones or whatever his real name is.
Harrison Ford?
Thank you.
It does not. No.
But he's Solo, right?
Correct. Yeah, good job, Radha. Congratulations.
I have so much of the pop culture.
But it's fine, but it also sounds like all the Star Wars, like, additional movies are kind of in shambles. There was a line out from Lucasfilm / Disney this week saying that they were like, they realized that they had kind of oversaturated the market. And it was like, yeah, no joke, people.
Yeah.
So now we're just waiting on episode 9 and whether we're ever going to get Mara Jade, which I know you're very invested in, Radha.
I'm not, but I will say that, like, the theory of Mara Jade, as it's been presented to me by you and Lauren, does make me more intrigued to watch such an episode.
Excellent.
So there you go.
Yeah, well, that's an N of one.
And now The Good Place is coming back, I think, like,
yes,
this week. So that is going to fill up a
I'm
hole
very,
in my pop
you know, they actually,
heart.
The Good Place is also available on these flights, and maybe I need to, like, get caught up on it. If folks haven't watched The Good Place, it's on Netflix. Half-hour episodes. They're excellent. You will enjoy them, and you're welcome.
Yeah.
That's it from us. We're going to go drink more wine here in sunny Sonoma. See you in a couple weeks.